Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. It's me, Cindy House. I host this podcast. Thanks for joining us today. We have Edie Carey and Sarah Sample on the pod. Of course, it's going to be awesome. You know it. I know it. It's what we're here for. Before we get into that, let's talk about some stuff. Have you signed up for the Basic Folk newsletter? It is a once-a-month email that comes to your inbox and lets you know what's going on with the pod. It's the best way to stay in touch. You can sign up for it at basicfolk.com, or you can go to the show notes. There is a direct link there. You can follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And you can make a contribution to Basic Folk. That is right. You can give us money. Have you ever heard of that concept before? It seems like everyone is doing it these days. And count us in. We also are asking for contributions. If you have enjoyed listening and you want to help make it happen, you can drop us a donation at basicfolk.com. There's also a link in the show notes there. All right, on with the show. Friends and collaborators Edie Carey and Sarah Sample teamed up in 2014 for their first album, Till the Morning, Lullabies and Songs of Comfort. The pair both had babies and were wanting to do a project that centered around calming music for both children and adults. They were actually shocked at the album's reception by adults, aka non-babies, who listened after experiencing grief, trauma, and huge loss. This type of music certainly had an important place in the world. And now they've done it again, but with more of a focus on calming music for adults with their follow-up, Lantern in the Dark, Songs of Comfort and Lullabies, which includes some originals, their first co-write, and new interpretations of songs by Wilco, The Beatles, Cyndi Lauper, and James Taylor. In our conversation, we tackle the concept of comfort. What's a good balance of comfort and what they experienced in the surprise reaction from their first record? It was also a great time to talk about their experience as touring musicians with young babies and the types of questions they would get asked that they are sure their male counterparts with young children would not get. They talk about the songs on the album, one of which was written by Edie in the aftermath of her mom's sudden and recent passing. We wrap it all up, of course, by hearing each of their James Taylor stories and a delightful bedtime-themed lightning round. Let's get into this conversation. We're going to hear clips from the new album, Lantern in the Dark, Songs of Comfort and Lullabies. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Edie Carey and Sarah Sample on Basic Folk.
Go back to sleep now, my darling, and I'll keep the bed dreams away. Breathe now, think sweet things, and I'll think of all the right words to say. Because we made you, my darling, with the love in each of our hearts, we were a family.
Okay, Edie Carey and Sarah Sample, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome. Woo. The new album is Lantern in the Dark, Songs of Comfort and Lullabies. This is your second venture into the world of lullabies. So let's start talking about, like, for each of you, what has been your experience with lullabies? Like, what memories come to mind when thinking about a lullaby?
My mom.
is what I think about, because my mother was the one to sing lullabies to me when I was little. I remember her singing Turn Around, which is a lullaby we actually put on our first record. And it's this reflective song about your baby growing up and becoming an adult. And then I think the last verse, isn't it about they turn around and you have a baby of your own? And I think that full cycle.
Very heavy for a child lullaby.
It is.
I mean, I don't remember, of course, processing that. I just remember my mom singing me that song. But I loved the melody and this kind of reflection of passing the torch to your child. You know, this generational thing. Anyway, I love that.
Well, I remember my mom, too. I don't think my dad told us kooky bedtime stories, but my mom would sing to us. And usually it was, we got to pick the main featured lullaby of the night. and then there was one that she would always sing, Now the Day is Over, which is my mom's favorite hymn. She would finish it with that. And I always remember as I got older, we'd be so, like, we kind of wanted to sing, but we were like, Mom, this is embarrassing. We're 13. Like, why are you still singing to us? And so the songs would just get faster and faster each time because she was trying to, like, squeeze it in before we'd eye roll her out of the room. But she would sing this song called Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod. That was a very popular song. It was an old song. I don't even know when it was from. But Now the Day is Over was, like, the nightcap song. Like, that's when she would sing that slowly as she's, like, backing out of the room. And we put that on our first record, too. So it's interesting that Sarah and I we picked songs, you know, the cover tunes that we loved for that record. But then we both picked songs that our moms had sung to us. It felt like they had to be in there.
But what's interesting is we've never talked about that.
No, we just learned that because of you, Cindy House.
Well, let's keep going here and learn all about each other.
Let's delve deeper.
So, all right, I'm thinking about, like, my, like, angsty teen into my 20s. I hate people in the suburbs. I would never get a minivan self. So with that in mind, I feel like the concept of comfort can be kind of scary. Like, you can become stagnant if you feel too comfortable. So for you, like, what does the balance of comfort look like? Like, how do you get the balance of that open-heartedness without turning into, like, a new agey drum circle live in the woods lady?
Well, who says I don't want to be that?
I know, honestly, like, me too.
I think Sarah is that already. Well, let's be real.
I have a cajon in my lap right now.
She had a cajon surgically attached to her body.
That's very special.
That's a real, you know, it's funny because I remember thinking those thoughts in my 20s, like, we go to Folk Alliance and I'd be like, this is very dream catchery vibe here. And I'm never going to be into that ever. And as I'm getting older and I live in the Southwest, I'm like, dream catchers are so beautiful. I love a chunky turquoise jewelry.
I have a Coca-Cola hanging from my dash right now.
Totally. So maybe these are the things that we get into as we get older. But in all seriousness, I think the comfort thing, we're musicians no matter what we do. You know, we become moms, and that is certainly part of our lives. And that is central, really, to our lives. But I think you spend so much of your day as a parent, whether your kid is tiny and they've fallen and skinned their knee and they need comfort, or your teenager is freaking out about something their friend said to them at school, we are trying to comfort them. And also we have our own bagage that's happening internally too. And we're absorbing their energy and trying to make them calm while we're worried about them and calming ourselves down. I feel like this is the most exhausting, amazing, exhilarating experience being a parent. And it's also something that requires as many chances as you can get to find comfort in a day that feels exhausting, in a day and years that feels exhausting. So Sarah's idea to make this first record, I thought, was so brilliant. That album was very much about calming your baby and having, because we had 1.5-year-olds or 2-year-olds at the time that we made it. It was about creating quiet at bedtime and all of those things. And then the songs that we chose ended up being very emotional. So that's why we sort of called it jokingly the Sleep and Weep album. This record, as our kids are now 10 years older and we're in different phases and experiencing loss and grief in so many areas of our lives, we are finding now at this juncture 10 years later that we need more comfort ourselves, and we see people with kids and parents passing away. The comfort has a different meaning on this record. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that was surprising about the last record is it was definitely meeting us where we were in that time of life, which was babies. But then the surprising side effect happened with the record, and that people were using the album for hospice, people were using the album for grief, for funerals, for all sorts of things. And we found that, you know, having a quiet, calming melody is a place where a lot of people need to land, not just babies. And so we actually, this album is much less baby focused and more adult themed and more adult songs of comfort. So,
and kind of a lot of, so many of our friends, you know, are in their 40s, early 50s now, and sort of reparenting themselves, whether they have kids or not, and going back and saying like, oh, all these things that I've carried as armor, as ways to deal with pain or run from pain, we're trying to sort of dismantle a lot of that stuff. Like the we did Chris Delmhorst's Lullaby 101, which I think is one of the most brilliantly written songs ever. The lyrics are absolutely incredible. That she wrote it in her 20s is so incredible to me. But it's all about the dropping of the armor and allowing yourself to rest and not have to prove yourself. So these songs, certainly you could put on for your baby and it would be very soothing and calming for them. But for the parents listening, hopefully it would then be calming, kind of, not to be hokey and dream catchery, but soothing the little kid in you that needs soothing. That feels really important on this record.
Yeah, and you talked about how, like, now is the right time to release a follow-up, which you just did in Lantern in the Dark, because the world has, like, really gone through the ringer recently. So when did you start talking about a follow-up, and what were those discussions like?
Well, we both have released solo records since the first duet album 10 years ago, and I think we both wanted to do that. I think we wanted to have that moment and then go back to our regular solo singer-songwriter lives and make adult records. But I think we, for many years, have been saying, we got to make another record. So I think we knew this was going to be on the horizon. It was just the timing of, I did my record in 2018 and Edie did hers a few years ago. And it was like, we both needed to put out solo records before we decided to come back together to do this project, because it's such a niche project. You know, it's not, how many albums do you have, Edie? It's like 800.
I think it's 800. It's about 800. thank you for that.
No, I think that, but I think it, you know, we wanted, we are primarily solo singer-songwriters. And so this was like a side project, but it's also become this really sweet, something fresh and something that's really joyful. I mean, when you're on the road by yourself all the time, it's lonely, and and you have, it's so, you wear so many hats as an independent artist. You are your own booker and you make your website and you sell the merch and you stock the merch and you put things on your credit card. I mean, there's so many jobs that you learn how to do over 20 years of doing this career. And so then to go into the project, not just with another musician, but with another seasoned musician who's already done it, all the jobs for themselves, there's something that's so easy and gratifying about being like, hey, we need to have a meeting. You update the website. I'll do this. You do this. And sparsing out the jobs, but with the confidence that, you know, the other person has already been doing those jobs for 20 years and knows what they're doing. So that there's something that feels really like, go team.
Yeah. We're always by ourselves usually. And it feels wonderful to do it with one of your best friends. And also the crappy stuff that happens, we can absorb and process together. And the great stuff that happens is that much more gratifying when you can like high five your friend in those moments.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so cool to hear about how not only are you both like emotionally capable of working with each other, but you're like, you meet each other at your level of professionalism.
Yeah. And we have really different skill sets, which, you know, Sarah's much more like laid back and I'm really type A and like over indexy. And I feel like she's a really good influence on me to like chill the hell out.
It yeah. Really but if is. We like re if we turn that in another view, like Edie is so perfectionistic about making sure that everything is right and that the edit is right and that the language is perfect and that we sound professional, you know, all these things that I need to be more like Edie. And so I think we were even saying this morning, like, we both can lean into each other's skill sets and rub off on one another.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot about, like, doing something well and also not being overthinky about it. Mm.
Well, I hope that we're overthinky on this next question.
Okay.
Oh, God. So hit us.
When you first came together, it was for the 2014 album Till the Morning, Lullabies and Songs of Comfort, which is 10 years old, and you've just released your follow-up album. So at that time in 2014, you were saying that you both had little babies. Mm-hmm. I think, Sarah, you had maybe two older kids and a little baby?
Two daughters. So my older daughter was 4 when my second one was born, so they're 4 years
old. Okay.
Yeah.
So I watched your Kickstarter video for that 2014 record. So here's what you said. Like, you mentioned in the video that you were still wanting to make records. And then this is me really reading into it. You still wanted to make records despite having young babies. Mm. And like, I read into that so much. Like, I feel like there have been more musician moms and like non-male parents speaking up about like the professional discrimination they face when they like become pregnant. Mm. I've heard from young musicians that they don't imagine themselves like giving birth and raising a baby because of like said discrimination. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you guys listen to The Other 22 Hours, which is like one of my favorite podcasts hosted mm-hmm. by Michaela Ann mm-hmm. and her husband, Aaron Schaefer Heiss. She talks about it all the time. I was just listening to her episode with the Lone Bellow, mm-hmm. Where Kaneen, the woman in the Lone Bellow, was also talking about this like weird discrimination she faced when she had a baby, like when she was pregnant, and then she actually like brought the baby on the road. She could feel like walking into a room, like she definitely didn't want to inconvenience anyone mm-hmm. because she had like a baby with her. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is a big topic, could be its own podcast episode. But what was your experience with that in your careers? And then how did like finding each other at that time maybe help you navigate?
Mm. That's a really good question. Well, I should say, I mean, Sarah was a real leader to me and seeing how she could weave music and motherhood together so beautifully. And I will say, Sarah and I have been incredibly lucky in that we both have had moms who have helped make that possible. Like, our moms would take our kids for us or come on tour with us and hold the baby while we were on stage, or stay at the hotel with the baby, put the baby to bed. And we, you know, you're like nursing and putting on mascara and writing a set list and then running out the door. And we had two incredible women who helped mm-hmm. really be the glue in that process, and very supportive husbands who would hold down the fort along with them. So that has been an essential component. And we have seen with friends of ours who are considering having kids but don't have that familial support, mm-hmm. feeling kind of like, I don't know how I'm going to make this work. I don't know how to make this possible, because this job is so all consuming. And it's more all consuming than ever because of all the things that we have to do that Sarah mentioned, you know, the laundry list of things that have to get done. And then the job of parenting is all consuming. So I understand anyone who's considering being a parent, taking real stock of like, what is my life going to look like? Mm-hmm. How can I be present for my kids and do this job and wrangle with? I mean, when I would go on tour and I, you know, people knew I'd had a child, they would be like, well, who has the baby? I'm like, well, my husband or my mom. They were like so confused. And I kept thinking, if I were a man on tour who had kids at home, would they be asking him the mm-hmm. same thing? And there would sort of be this implicit, like, what are you doing out here when you have a baby at home or a baby at the hotel? So I'd either get guilt for like bringing the baby on tour, like this is traumatic for your kid, or what are you doing being away from them? I don't know. But I think Sarah was a real guide for me in that process. You know, what do you want to say about that?
Well, I remember my career, I had made a few records and I was starting to tour a lot more and have like getting out of college and being able to tour nationally. I was starting to do a lot more of that. And when I found out that I was pregnant with my first daughter, I remember sobbing. I mean, I really wanted to have a baby intellectually, but I also knew that it would change my career trajectory. And I also was so afraid of what that would mean for my career. Mm-hmm. Because you're right. I mean, how do you take on the job of like having a baby and also take on the job of touring? And it's comical. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is so much. It is so consuming that it's very frightening. And I looked at a lot of my idols in the genre of music that I love, and they were all single and no babies. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the examples in front of me of how to make that possible. And like Edie said, these standards, these expectations that we place on women are not just for musicians. I mean, I'm a nurse in my day job life, and I see women, they are being expected to work outside the home full time. But then the studies show that they are also running their households. Mm-hmm. So they're doing double full-time work. And then the expectations of just like, if you're not with your kids all the time, then you're a bad mom. If you're home with your kids all the time, then you're not contributing.
You're not fulfilling your womanly and career expectations.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the physical symptoms of nausea and of how uncomfortable, like the changes your body goes through during pregnancy, working through that when you're at a 9-to-5 job is exhausting and so hard. And then I see women coming in and they're nursing in the closet. They're like pumping in the closet mm-hmm. before they get back to the shift where everyone else is resentful that you've been gone 15 minutes. I mean, there's so many things in place that we can do better about supporting women in the workplace, but also when you apply that to a touring musician, it becomes nearly impossible if you don't have the support systems that Edie mentioned we were lucky enough to have with our moms. And also then you compound that with the financial aspect of still musicians aren't being fairly compensated, and it's so hard to make a living being a touring musician that if you're like, okay, well, I don't have a mom who can come on the road, the ability for you to pay for a nanny to watch your kid is also mm-hmm. nearly impossible.
Well, just like anyone who has to go to a job, they think, well, daycare might cost as much as the job that I'm taking is paying me. Mm-hmm. So then you do the math and you're like, maybe I just should stay home.
Right.
So, and I also will say too, I mean, I had a really pretty significant fertility struggles to have both of my kids. I did 6 full years for both kids, 6 full years and 3-year stints of fertility treatments while touring. And that really cut into my ability to make money because I would be like, well, I have to be home for this cycle. I don't know how that's going to work. And if I plan, so trying to plan that was logistically really hard. So even before I became a mother, I had to kind of roll my career way back before I even had a baby. And then I sort of thought of early motherhood time was like, I just got to keep my career like on life support. Like, I'm not going to shut it down completely. I'll continue to tour, but I'm not going to be able to be making records because I'm like barely holding it together. And also that was such a happy time, but it was hard to have to let go of that. And I don't mm-hmm. know any career where women do not have to do that to some degree. And that's also wonderful because you want to enjoy that time. Mm-hmm. But every woman's career suffers greatly when they have a baby. There's just no way around that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I want to dig a little deeper into this topic. Mm-hmm. When thinking about, you covered Wilco's My Darling, mm-hmm. And Edie felt especially emotionally connected to this song mm-hmm. Because of your infertility journey. Mm-hmm. And I also just want to like talk more about like, you know, childbirth and periods and menopause mm-hmm. and stuff on this podcast, because I don't feel like it gets talked about
absolutely
very much, like reproductive health and mm-hmm. all that. So since your experience, Edie, like how have you seen like the overall infertility journey evolve?
Mm, that's so interesting. You know, I had my daughter, my youngest child is now 8, and that part of my life, which was so significant for 10 years as just like the world I lived in. I ran a support group in my apartment in Chicago. I went to a support group and then ended up taking that group over and running it in my apartment. It was very central to my life. It kind of was as important as music was in many ways, because when you've been through that experience, it is unbelievable the marks that it leaves on your psyche. I still see pregnant people. I have two beautiful children, 12 and 8, and I see pregnant people and I have like deep feelings of jealousy, and I mean, I can manage them, but like it is a true PTSD when you've had miscarriage, when you've had just no after no pregnancy test, you know, negative pregnancy test after negative pregnancy test. At our show that we played last night, a woman who's in her late 60s, early 70s came up to me with tears in her eyes because I mentioned my fertility struggles on stage. She said, you know, I have a son who's 28 years old. I had him and then I tried for 6 more years to have another child and I never could. Tears streaming down her face. And she's like, I have a son and I still have so much loss and trauma from that. So those things still live in me. And I'm also immensely grateful that I have these two kiddos. But it is still, I'm forever changed by it. And anytime I meet anyone who's going through that, I want to help them get to a resolution as fast as possible, because women sharing information with each other is so helpful. I mean, what you said about talking about periods and menopause and all the ways that we can say, I was there too. Can I offer a suggestion? Maybe it will be helpful for you. Women are incredible the way that they do that, whatever the subject may be. So that is a big passion. I have like 3 people that are in my life right now who are going through that journey, and I'm trying to support them as best I can. And Sarah was an enormous support during that time. She had not gone through infertility, but Sarah is a deeply compassionate person and is so good at meeting you wherever you are emotionally. And you were one of the main people that helped me get through that time and make me feel like it might actually work out.
Yeah, I wanted to say that, Sarah, I read your blog post. This was from like 2012, where you were talking about your experience with like the births of your children. And both of them sounded really like complicated, complex. One of them sounded really scary. You had some intense pregnancy symptoms that you did not go into detail about on your blog. And you were being like kind of funny about it, but also like it sounded really scary and horrible. But so, like, Sarah, what's your take on how little is talked about in those complications of pregnancy and complications of childbirth and like women's health in general? And have you noticed it like changing?
It's interesting because I think there's this fine line of when you speak to women who are newly pregnant with their first babies, sometimes we tend to want to like trauma dump on them. Like, here are all the things. Let me tell you about my horrible delivery or my C-section that went wrong, whatever it is. And so I think there's this fine line that you have to walk, because there's already so much trepidation in a body of like, how am I physically changing? My body's changing in all these new ways. There's all these hormones that are surging through my body. I'm gaining weight. I'm nauseous, I'm vomiting, I have headaches, I'm swelling, I have to take my rings off. I mean, there's so many things that we don't really address. And so on one hand, I feel like when you go in to trying to tell people about your experience, it doesn't ease their anxiety going into what birth will be like for them. So I think you have to be careful about that, because you don't know, they could have a wonderful birth experience. And I don't want to go in and say like, well, this is what happened to me. But I also think that some of the best advice I was given was I took like a birthing class, and a doula basically said, set up your expectations for your birth of what you want, and then realize it will change. It's never going to be like, you can plan all you want for what your delivery will be like. And she was like, but it will be different than you plan. And so she was like, and she also kind of said to me, I was living in Seattle when my first daughter was born. And I remember there was kind of the debate of like home birth versus hospital birth versus medicated, unmedicated. see, you know, do you want to have an epidural? All of these things. And I remember her saying to me, she was like, all birth is natural. Whether you have a C-section, whether you have an epidural, whether you have a partial epidural, like birth, whether it's medicated or unmedicated, is natural. Mm-hmm. And it's going to look different for every person to navigate. But that helped me kind of take the pressure off myself. Because I remember I joined, like, one thing that really saved my life when I was in Seattle was I joined a women's group called PEPS. And I would encourage anyone who has an organization like this in their town to use it, because it pairs new moms with other women in your location, in your area, with babies the same age. So we had probably like 7 or 8 moms in Seattle, all first babies, all within the same month of being born.
So you're going through everything together.
You're going through everything together. Mm-hmm. And so you'd show up and you're, you know, spit up, vomit, you know, all over your clothes, and your baby isn't sleeping, and you're crying, and they're crying, and
your boobs are leaking.
Yeah, all these things, but it just normalizes it, and it makes it so that, like, I mean, I remember in the first, you know, with my first baby, she wasn't what they call like a nutritive feeder. So she wasn't, like, I wasn't producing enough milk. She wasn't drinking enough. So then I would have to nurse her for what she could take, pump off the rest, supplement with a bottle, and weigh her to make sure she was getting enough. And it was a 2-hour process.
Oh, God. And then by the time you're done, you actually have to feed her again.
And and I remember after like 3 months of this, I was so just in despair. I felt like a failure, like my body is not producing enough milk and she's not drinking enough and all of these things. And I was going to the lactation specialist once a week with her, and it was like so complicated. And I remember my husband James at the time saying, like, you know, it's okay if we just give her a bottle, like, if we just
let's dial back the suffering is at an 11 right now. Let's just bring it to like a 6.
I remember then using formula, like, being like, screw this. Like, I'm just going to give her a bottle of formula. And she was on formula 4 months on. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I then, like, my group was able to be like, don't feel bad about this. Like, you didn't have a great breastfeeding experience with your first baby. Mm-hmm. She's still going to be a healthy, beautiful baby. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, it really was very helpful. And then my second baby breastfed beautifully, and it was a totally different thing. So I don't know. Yes.
There are all these ways we can feel not enoughness in our music life, in our mom life.
Turns out, even with breastfeeding.
Turns out it's in your vocal cords and in your breastal region.
Yeah. Was that enough detail for you? Do you want me to tell you
about... Tell me about your nipple chafing.
Yeah. Do you want me to go into the birth?
That was next level.
A friend of mine calls it, I can't remember what you called it, Sarah, but a friend of mine calls it trauma porn.
Trauma porn. Yes.
Trauma porn. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. And it's interesting because I have to be really careful with my fertility stuff when I'm sharing. I have still so much trauma when I talk about everything we went through and like just bad news after bad news. And so I want to make someone feel like their story is not weird or out there. I'm be like, alone. This is what we went through. And then I realize I'm re-traumatizing myself by telling the story.
Right.
And then I'm traumatizing them because they're like, I didn't even consider that possibility. No, I'm really scared. Right. So and I'm sure I'm guilty of doing that and trying to kind of feel connected and be empathic. I think sometimes it's hard to not sort of touch on that place and be like, right, that was really hard. And I need to like talk myself through it again. So I often have to make myself dial it back a little bit.
Right. Well, at least it sounds like you're like a quarter percentage aware.
I don't even know if you're I'd like be 25%. That generous, but maybe 10. Maybe 10. I'm going to go with the solid 10. 10.
Okay.
Yeah. There is a term for when somebody tells you what they're going through and then you then share your experience and like take
their
away moment.
From their yes,
and like
it's a one-upmanship.
Yeah,
is that that's not the word?
But there is a term. I know what you mean. There's a
term where it's basically, and I work in oncology, and what happens all the time is somebody starts talking about that their mom had cancer or that they have cancer, and then the person they're talking to goes, "My mom had cancer," you know, like
yes.
My aunt died of
right.
whatever.
The very thing you have.
Right. and it's this, it's a need to connect. It's right. not that they're trying to take over.
Yeah.
It's this thing of like, let me show you that I know what you're going through and I'm right. trying to support you. But you're right. It is a fine line with whatever it is, with birth, with infertility, with cancer, with all the things where you want to allow someone to have their moment. And tell their story mm-hmm. and also feel seen and heard.
Mm-hmm. So I'm looking up synonyms for one-upsmanship.
In trauma.
I don't think any of this is gamesmanship, competition. These aren't the words.
Trauma it's hijacking.
Like, yeah, it's like a hijacking.
Trauma hijacking.
I think let's just yes. call it trauma hijacking. Mm-hmm. I know that one. I have been guilty of that so many times in my life, and my intention is good. Because I want to be like, I get it, I understand. Mm-hmm. And then about a minute in, I'm like, what am I, why? Speedy,
yeah.
clamp it. This is not helpful.
Happened.
Yes, yeah. I'm
there
hijacking.
There is a time, though, for relating. And there is a time to say, I've experienced what you're going through. Mm-hmm. Or whatever it mm-hmm. is. But yeah, it is a thing where it's like reading the room. Is the person who's sharing their experience, what do they need?
Yeah. Sitting with whatever they're going through instead of feeling like you have to hold up a mirror to it, you know.
Okay, I wanted to ask a couple of questions about songs on Lantern in the Dark. The first track is called I'm Here. It was written by Catherine Shore of Sweet Talk Radio and Kyler England, who I remember her name from mm-hmm. college radio.
Yeah.
And, she was, I remember, like, I hadn't heard of her for a long, long while, I think because she's on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, exactly what she looked like. She was, like, so beautiful.
Gorgeous.
I remember seeing her in college and, like, lots of, like, purple imagery on her CDs. Mm-hmm. And I, like, saw a picture of her. I'm like, she looks exactly the same.
She does.
So congratulations, Kyler England.
Yeah. You're nailing it,
this
Kyler.
This song was intentionally chosen as the first track. And it's kind of like a thesis statement for the record. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you're hurting and alone, we're here.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one reoccurring Edie Carey theme I've heard in my life before. Mm-hmm. But for both of you, like, why do you think it is that when someone faces a trauma in their lives, it's like so easy to feel alone? And what do you do to let people know that you're there for them despite trauma hijacking?
Mm. Well, I think that in my efforts to send the message that I'm here, I'm sure that I have trauma hijacked a fair amount, all with love in my heart and good intentions. But I think deep female friendship has been a huge thing in my life. Our relationship as musicians and friends is just deeply healing on so many levels. And so many of our singer-songwriter friends feel like family to us. And in the times that we're going through hard things, like, what a joy to be able to share with people who also understand this weird life that we've chosen. So just showing up and saying, I love you, and you can tell me all the things, and it's safe here, and I get it and understand. But we're doing, I mean, that's in our sort of community of musicians. But we're moms, and you know, we talk a lot about, we both listen to Dr. Becky Kennedy, who's an amazing child psychologist. And Sarah and I, in the last couple of days, have been talking a lot about, she has this whole analogy about a bench, like when your kid is struggling with something, go and sit on the bench with them instead of like standing over the bench and being like, I know that you're upset, but this is really not that big a deal. Like, get off the bench. Let's like get back into the game. Or trying to move them to another bench because we're deeply uncomfortable with whatever they're going through. And I think
it's called Good Inside.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She's so good.
So it's a podcast called Good Inside with Dr. Becky.
She's wonderful.
She does such a great job. Yeah, follow. She's phenomenal. And what I think she's so good at, and I have to constantly relearn this, because when my kids are struggling or my husband is struggling, I'm deeply uncomfortable because I want them to be okay because I'm worried about them. And so I want to like somehow, my intentions once again are good, but I want to like talk them out of their feelings. And so the whole bench analogy is like, don't try to move them from where they are. Just as we want, mm-hmm. you know, when we're upset, we just want somebody to hear us. We don't want them to talk us out of it. We don't want them to solve it for us. We just want to be sat with and mm-hmm. be where we are. And her whole idea is like, don't show your kids that you're not comfortable with their big feelings, that their big feelings are manageable and reasonable and right and good. And they're all part of like the full human experience. And I feel like I fail at that so often. But I keep coming back to trying to just sit in the moment, whether it be my friend or my kiddo or my partner, to just let them have their space and not try to like cajole them mm-hmm. out of it. That's how I'm trying to show up for I'm here.
I love it. I also, we talk about one of the big goals of the record is to demand nothing of the listener. We don't need you to adjust the volume when track 8 comes on because it's too loud. We don't need
There's no bangers
on this record. We don't need you to engage with it. We need you to actually let it just be a landing place for you and to meet you where you're at. And it's going to be soft and comforting and loving
and emotional.
And emotional, and it'll mm-hmm. meet you whatever the moment is, whether mm-hmm. the moment is grief or anger or
overwhelm,
whatever it is, it's going to be there and demand nothing of you. And I love that. I love that it's just like a peaceful sonic land to be in. Mm-hmm. And we had a listener, a friend of ours with our first record who had no children. She was a fan of Edie's and had supported the record just as like, I love Edie Carey, I'm going to be part of the Kickstarter. She didn't have kids and she felt like, well, in order to listen to this record, I need to have children. Mm-hmm. So she had never listened to the album. And then tragically, her brother had committed suicide. And she said the only thing she could listen to for months was the Lullaby album because it was the only thing like soft enough for her. Mm-hmm. And that was such a big lesson to us about what music can do and how it can actually be supportive instead of like, listen to my latest heartbreak, mm-hmm. you know, and tune into the lyric on verse 3. This mm-hmm. is where it changes. This is really where it elevates. It's like, we don't need you to do that on this record.
Well, and also I think so many people feel as they're in the age group we are, where you're doing a lot of reflecting on your early life. We have so many friends who have said this phrase to us, like, my parents were good. Like there was food, we were cared for, everything was okay, but nobody checked in with me. Nobody mm-hmm. asked me like, how am I doing? I was a kid amongst a lot of other kids and I felt lost and not seen. I was in like this brood of children and no one checked in on my emotions. And I love the idea that somebody who felt not parented and not checked in with or really cared for on an emotional level, I mean, that's a lofty thing to say about a record, but like that you hope that maybe this would feel a little bit like I can feel cared for, like someone puts me in an emotional hot bath.
I don't think it's a lofty thing, Edie. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually like was just proven by the story that Sarah mm-hmm. shared where mm-hmm. it did happen for someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was an extraordinary thing when someone has that experience and they actually take the time to write a letter to us to tell us that, because I think so often you feel like you're sending your songs into the ether and you're like, I hope mm-hmm. people are receiving this. And when you do shows, you know, you talk to people and it's a much more immediate connection. But to know that even when you don't hear from people, it is making change. It is making people feel cared for and seen. And that is ultimately what we care about.
The next song I wanted to talk about was Blackbird, which I don't think we can share a clip of since we don't have it would probably be like millions of dollars,
yes.
maybe. To
yep.
play, yes. Mm-hmm. Trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Blackbird, a song by the Beatles. But it's, go listen to the record. It's a beautiful version. It's a song that Edie had been covering for a while. You first learned it for a wedding, mm-hmm. And fans requested for this to be on the record. And again, the arrangement is really beautiful.
Thank you.
Beyonce also released a version of Blackbird.
Yes, Queen Bee.
This year with black country singers Brittany Spencer, Raina Roberts, Tanner Adele, Tiara Kennedy. It came out on her country record yep. earlier this year. Paul McCartney wrote it in response to the civil rights movement. Yeah. Blackbird equals black girl. It's like very meaningful that Beyonce did this song. Mm. It's a beautiful version as well. So it's a song about suffering and rising up in spite of it, and it fits right into your record. However, like, what was it like to release this cover now that Beyonce has recorded it? The same year.
Yeah. We did have that conversation in the studio. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't really know how do you remember having that conversation?
Yeah.
And we were like, is this a good idea? Because
yeah.
it was a very game time decision. It was a song I'd been singing for like 17 years. And I should say Rose Cousins helped me make the original arrangement because I was on tour with her right before that
Shout
wedding.
Out.
And I was like, Rose, I have to play this wedding in 2 days. I'm never going to learn that guitar part in time. And she was like, let's folkify it. So we just simplified it and did very like Rose Cousins-y, like suspended chord type sounds. And got to give her a shout out. So when we were in the studio, we were, I feel like, mostly done with the record. And we had like three more songs we wanted to add. And we had this long master list of what songs we wanted to add. And I can't really remember what made us go in that direction, because to me, it felt like sort of old news. Like, I've been playing the songs for so long. But then for Sarah, it felt more novel.
Yeah, I loved this version. It feels different than other versions that I've heard. And also, I don't really believe in like the comp. I don't believe in the mindset of like, well, Beyonce did it, so I can't.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's plenty of room in the universe mm-hmm. for as many songs as we want to make. So, but you know, like it didn't feel like a threat that mm-hmm. Beyonce had done it. If anything, I'm like, yeah, she's inspiring us. Like, I love to follow in her footsteps. Of
right, but as two white women, I think we both were a little bit like, is this really our song to sing?
Right.
And yet, I also feel like I don't know what it is about that song. I mean, when you hear the original version, the guitar part is very sort of like classically inspired, and it's. The guitar part is really the central thing that I think draws people in initially, and then you tune into the words. Like, I'd been playing it for years before I even knew about the tie to the civil rights movement and mm-hmm. specifically black women. And I was like, holy crap. Like, that makes the song so much more beautiful,
and
so
powerful.
Much more meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think, I remember thinking when we had the conversation in the studio, like, yeah, is this too close to Beyonce's release? And then I also thought, okay, so that's not our realm and that's not our story to tell as two white women. But I also remember thinking, this is a song about vulnerability. It's a song about feeling wounded, being stronger than you think you are, and rising above it. And that, and also just like an overcoming. That's what it feels like. You've been through this incredibly hard thing, whatever that thing is, loss or pain or grief, and that you will never be the same as you were before that experience. You are galvanized by it, and then you move through it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's a universal story that every single person relates to. And that's why everybody keeps friggin' covering the song, because it's so simple and so massively universal at the same time.
Mm-hmm. In our old dining room, candlelight, friends gathered on a frigid night, and we're all safe and warm inside. You're holding me, my head so heavy on your heart. There's nothing scary in the dark.
The next song I want to talk about is Edie's song, All the Ways You Comfort Me. You wrote this song just over a month after your mom died really suddenly. You were trying to make sense of everything, especially mm-hmm. what you do with like the good memories and the hard parts.
Mm.
What have you learned about grief through this song, All the Ways You Comfort Me?
Well, I've only probably played it live maybe 10 times since I wrote it last year.
How's that been?
Haven't made it through once without crying. Well, actually, when we sang at Folks Fest in Lyons this past summer, I did sing the song without crying, but the intro I was fully crying. So at some point, either right before or during, it's challenging, especially in a live setting when you're performing, you're looking at people in the audience and you're kind of, your energy is mixing with the audience's memory and the audience's facial expressions and their emotion. It's very hard to not have I could be okay, and then I look at someone who looks teary and I'm like, oh shit, then I'm gonna completely fall in. And I think it's interesting because when you write a song, usually you're a little bit north of the pain, like you're a little just above it, so you can like be looking at it, you're close to the original emotion, but you're not falling into it and can't crawl back out. But I wrote this song when I was still deeply, deeply grieving. And Sarah and I were actually at a songwriting retreat in Texas that Megan Burt runs. And I a lot of that time is blurry, but I was roommates with Sarah and I was like, I can't think of a better time to go to a songwriting retreat. And I wrote the song while I was there, just sitting on the bed next to Sarah bawling. And I usually would probably have waited much longer to be able to synthesize the experience and write about it, but it felt like this very safe space to do it. So this, all of that is to say, because I've only sung it, you know, I recorded it a couple times on the record and then I've played it a few times live. It still feels so raw. We haven't played it yet on tour and I'm a little nervous about it, but I also feel like, okay, it's like when you go to a funeral or a memorial service and the person who's giving the eulogy is often nervous, like, what if I start crying or I get really emotional in front of all these people? What I always want to say to them is, so what? Then you become the release valve for all the feelings in the room and everybody can cry and then everybody can let go. Mm-hmm. But when it's me, I'm like, I gotta hold it together. No one's fucking expecting me to hold it together. My mom died so suddenly. But it just sometimes feels like I'm still too close to the experience to like be able to present the song properly. And that's okay. I have to sit, because I'm very perfectionistic, it's really hard for me to just know that I'm so sure, deeply raw about the experience.
Another reoccurring theme for Edie Carey shows up in this song. Basically, the theme is, you love me despite not having experienced the same love. So I got that from the line, your mother never knew quite how, barely spoke the words out loud, but somehow you knew how to love me.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of a song from The Veil, an album I'm very familiar with, The Day You Were Born, which is a song about a man who is able to love his spouse, love his family, despite not having a loving father.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recognize that theme, and why do you think you're so taken with that trait in people?
It's a great question.
I
know. I had never thought about that parallel. Yeah, that song is written for my husband, Matt. You know, he had a very absent, and even when present, very absent dad. I think, well, it's sort of like the Blackbird theme, like the idea that you can have neglect and pain and loss, and that you can stay in that space, stay stagnant, and stay in the hurt, or you can say, "Okay, this hurts like hell, but I want to be able to turn that pain into something beautiful." And whether it's creatively or in how you show up for the people in your life, I think I find it extraordinary when you see someone who's been through major trauma and they are able to have a full, robust life. They're not guarded and covered in some kind of armor all the time. We all have that to some degree. But I find that incredibly moving. And it's hard to not want to write about that because it's an extraordinary feat to do it. And think about any small change you want to make in your emotional life, how freaking hard it is to do it, to maintain it. And when you see people doing it on a grand scale in a way you wouldn't think they would be able to, given what they may have gone through, I just think that's an extraordinary thing. And my mother did not have lots of love and support in her life. And she was I mean, and she and I had our issues for sure, but man, was she present and loving and open-hearted and consistent in ways that she never had. How the hell did she do that? I just think it's incredible. Without support, you know, and I had all of that, and I still find it so hard to do those things consistently. So I think it's pretty remarkable.
Forgive me. You forgive me. All the ways you comfort me. The sun to set tonight. I don't want the stars to shine their light.
Sarah, you wrote the song Shine about the awe and ache of watching children grow up. And in the track by track that you guys wrote, you wrote, as parents, we relish the beauty and growth of our kids while simultaneously willing time to slow down. So now that you have a 16-year-old and you have growing children, how have you tried to, like, slow down in your parenthood? Like, what hot tips can you give us? Like, what works, what doesn't work?
Yeah, great question. Sometimes I think I try to, I don't know, like, you just want to tell them everything. You want to, like, get into the weeds and really, like, always be processing. And let me tell you about, I don't know, like, I think sometimes I tend to want our conversations to always be really deep and meaningful.
Imparting wisdom.
I tend to be a personality that I don't want to stay on the surface. I immediately want to, like, get to the good stuff or, you know, the heart of the issue when I connect with people. And I think that is a strength that Edie and I both have, is that we don't stay on the surface. We immediately want to go deep with people and connect deeply with people. And so I think sometimes my children are like, okay, mom. Like, my daughter has said to me several times this year, like, mom, it's not that deep, you know?
Stop analyzing it, mom.
Yeah, like, we don't need to turn every, like, meal time into, like, but how did that feel?
But let's talk about body issues.
Yeah.
Over our pasta dinner. Come on.
Let me go get my dream catcher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Light the peyote, Joan.
Yeah.
So one thing just personally in my life that's been a huge change this year is I stopped drinking a year ago. And that for me has been a huge shift that I don't really talk about. But that has been a really big shift in my immediate family and the way that I connect to my children. It has allowed me to be present in a way that I wasn't before. And it has allowed me to be available in a way that I wasn't. Especially, like, you know, as the evening rolls around and you start having a few glasses of wine and whatever else, like, you're not going to go to Walmart at 10 p.m., you know, like, because you're like, I'm not going to drive right now or whatever. And it has really freed me up to have the time and availability to be present and, like, up for anything in a way that I couldn't be before. And I think also alcohol for me was kind of like I was checking out into, like, a way to relax or take the edge off or something else. But it also meant that I was kind of checking out of my relationships at home. And I just have felt a huge difference in my connection to my children in the last year and my husband. And not that, like, we're always going to connect deeply, but that the fact is that, like, any time of day, I have a clear mind to be able to if I need to.
I don't want the sun to set tonight.
All right, one more question, and let's do a bedtime-themed lightning round.
Okay.
You close the album with a James Taylor song, You Can Close Your Eyes. You have had JT's songs woven throughout your lives since you were children. So could you each tell me your James Taylor stories?
Mm. Oh, God. I actually have a couple James Taylor stories.
I love JT.
Oh, we both do. I have two JT stories. One is just, that's a song that we always, my dad always had James Taylor. It was basically like James Taylor, Carole King, and then George Winston's December. That was literally all that played on the record player at my dad's house. My parents were divorced. My mom's house was all R&B. But at my dad's house, JT was like the number one.
Standard.
And you know when you're a kid, you get like weird kid logic things happening? Like I thought my mother was and Susan Lucci were the same person because they looked really similar. And so when my mom would go to work and I would see Susan Lucci on all my children at my babysitter's house, I was like, there's mom. That's where she is. And I thought my dad and James Taylor were the same person because they looked really similar. Bald spot, tall, skinny, white dudes. So I thought my dad and James Taylor were the same because my dad would sing along. He has a really nice voice. So that was confusing. And then I just knew all of his songs. And then this is crazy. When I lived in Italy for my junior year abroad, I lived with six other women, some American, some Italian. And one of the women in my apartment, her best friend was Sally Taylor, who's James Taylor and Carly Simon's daughter. And she came to visit, like just stayed with us for a couple of days. And I was like, we were all sharing photos of our family because it was like 1994. So nobody had like electronic photos. We all had photos of our families in our wallets. And then she pulls it out. I'm like, yeah, of course, that's your dad. And that's your mom. I'm like,
oh, my
what the
gosh.
Hell? And then Carly Simon and James Taylor kept calling our house to check in on Sally because she was just hanging out with us in Italy. So when the phone would ring, we would all like leap for the phone because we'd be like, I want to talk to them. So a bunch of my friends talked to Carly on the phone. And one day I got there and I was like, pronto, just how you say hello in Italian. And it was James Taylor on the phone. He's like, hello. I was like, no, I'm American. I'm going to get Sally for you. But I got to talk to James on the phone for a minute. It was very
exciting.
I've
never heard this story.
Isn't that hilarious? Anyway, those are my JT stories.
Well, you win. I don't even.
Well, no, but what's your experience? I mean, you probably played JT on the guitar when you were like eight.
So when I got my first guitar in sixth grade, my mom gave me her old classical Yamaha. And my sister was going to this like bougie hippie private school where they like ride bikes across Nova Scotia, things like that.
Sounds nice.
And they had, of course, a songbook that was like the folk songbook that they all knew the songs and whatever. And there were several JT songs. Mm-hmm. So Fire and Rain.
Of course.
You've Got a Friend.
Yeah.
Sweet Baby James. Mm-hmm. All the things. And so those were some of my first folk songs on guitar that I went through that whole book over and over and over and playing. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Mm. You know?
So good. Little baby Sarah.
Don't sing too much of it. We can't afford the copyright.
Oh, yeah. I do.
Don't worry. I wasn't singing that. But yeah, Something in the Way She Moves, all of it. So those were some of my first early folk songs learning to play on the guitar.
Yeah. I think he was a seminal artist for so many folkies of our age range.
I wonder if we just launched into a JT hour of a show, if we're just like, we're just going to do a sing-along James Taylor hour. I bet our audience would know every song.
I know.
Yeah.
So good. So good.
Particularly in the New England region.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
All right, ladies. You ready for the lightning round?
Totally.
What's the lightning round?
It's just wicked fast.
Oh.
So just, are you ready?
Okay. No.
Take a sip of your coffee.
And these questions are bedtime themed.
Okay. We are so prepared.
Of both of your families, who is the best at going to bed?
Me.
Oh, yeah. Of both of our families?
Yeah.
Like, oh.
What does that mean?
Like, you mean just to us or our kids too?
We're ruining the lightning
of
round.
Sarah's family and Edie's family.
Oh, who in the family is best at going to bed?
Who in the family is
the
best?
Oh, sorry. Okay, let's start again. Your family. Okay. You're the best? Oh, yeah, Sarah's the best.
I go to bed at 8.
Sarah climbs into bed at 8 o'clock. And then if you want to hang out with her, they have to come hang out on the bed.
They have to come into bed.
Right? I would say my son. He lies in bed and is asleep in like 1 second. And it's amazing. He was like that as a baby, and I felt very grateful. And he's still like that at 12.
Wow, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, now who is the worst?
What about your house?
My husband. He's up noodling, doing, I don't know what he's doing.
Late night futzing?
Late night doing something. Who knows? Because I'm asleep. I don't know what.
Yeah, you're asleep at 8:30. The worst is my husband, too. He is up just watching a lot of YouTube videos of things that I wouldn't want to watch. And he's like, thank, she's gone now. I can dive in.
Like drywalling or what? What's he watching?
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yes. World War II videos, Ukraine weapon
news.
Videos.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm out.
Okay. So we got Sarah's bedtime is 8:30. Edie, what's your bedtime?
It's like 9:30 or 10. If I'm feeling crazy, 10:30.
10:30. All right. Mm-hmm. What is your nighttime ritual?
I always read in bed before I go to bed. So, and I also, I've started having ice cream almost every single night. So I'll have like a scoop of ice cream. I'll read a book and then I'll like, my family will like come into my bed. My dogs are in the bed. Everyone's like in the bed and I have to kick everyone out at some point. Like, get out of here. And then lights out.
What kind of ice cream?
Right now, my favorites are Häagen-Dazs coffee, or I love 31 Flavors mint chocolate chip.
Oh, those are my two favorites.
What?
I knew I loved you. My bedtime routine usually consists of, well, I once I get the kids in bed, like in the eights, then I go downstairs with a Mount Everest-sized pile of laundry to be folded, because if I start watching a show with my husband, I will, without doing an activity, I will be asleep in about 4 minutes. He'll be like, what Netflix show do you want to watch the opening credits of? You shouldn't even be involved in the choice. So then I take an activity. So I bring all the laundry downstairs and I fold the laundry and we'll watch an episode. And then I go to sleep around 9:30. It's very boring. It's very boring. But
that
I love it.
That actually is a really good idea, though.
It's great.
For what to do.
Yeah. Then I won't fall asleep. It's that, or I'd have to like start knitting or something. But I would. It's just the minute I'm comfortable and I have a dog on either side of me, I'm out.
You're out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is the last question. What kind of sleeper are you? Side, back, stomach, all
for
three?
For sure, stomach. But I had a game changer moment in the last 2 years. We got new pillows. And we paid like a lot of money for these pillows. They're called Coop pillows. And COOP, like a chicken coop.
This is an ad for Coop pillows.
Yeah, and they're honestly like game changing.
So do you sleep differently?
Sometimes I'm on my side, but I like to sleep on my stomach too.
God, I can't. After having babies,
wait, Sarah, where are your arms in this when you're on your stomach?
I'm a full sprawl.
You're an X.
But the pillow is almost like down my whole body. Like I'm like it's almost like down through my stomach or something. Like I'm not, it's not just my head. It's like my whole body is laying on the pillow.
Oh,
almost.
I want to get one of those. I used to be a belly sleeper because I feel like you sleep really deeply on your belly. But as soon as I had pregnant belly, I was like, obviously I couldn't do that. And then I was like, I don't know. It just hurts my boobs. So I lie on my left side always. Left side.
Left side.
Well, this has just really been so insightful. I've learned so much. Thank you very much for sharing everything in our interviews. It was great. I loved it.
Thank you
so
much.
We loved it. Thank you so much, Cindy.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can check us out on Folk Alley's mobile app or folkalley.com. Or you can go to our website, basicfolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who is very nervous. Your nervous friend that's always worried about everything. Not only does that person need to hear this interview with Edie and Sarah, but they need to go out and listen to this new record because it is very calming. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.